This is Josh Summers, and you're listening to Everyday Sublime, the podcast where I endeavor through stories and reflections and conversations, I endeavor to explore a full spectrum spirituality, incorporating and awakening to the highs, the lows, and the plateaus. And in this episode, I'm taking another pass. I've been reflecting on this famous Buddhist parable called The Tiger and the Snake, or the Parable of the Tiger and the Snake. And I gave one talk on it, one episode on it before, but I want to come back to it. And the reason I'm coming back to it is I think the more I've reflected on the story, the more that I see how much it actually describes, in some ways, the entirety of the spiritual path, beginning in a state of blissful oblivion and then feeling trapped and caught and terrified, to ultimately waking up to something, ultimately waking up out of a dream state, if you will. So I'm giving this story another pass on the show because I think there's so much in it that speaks to the spiritual path in general, but also to our collective predicament or our collective experience right now as a result of everything we see in the news. In my heart, there's a special urgency around practices that wake us up, that go for it, that really ignite in an experience of inner knowing and inner realization. So I hope you enjoy this talk. And before I give it to you, I just want to say that if you would like support in your practice, if you're looking for a low-key but really profound in some ways practice of embodiment using yin yoga, that's a very safe, gentle, meditative form of yoga practice, combined with somatic movement practices of qigong that my partner Terry teaches. And if you'd like to weave those embodiment practices into a creative and open-ended contemplative practice based on early Buddhist meditation, then we might be your community. And we invite you to join us. We're called the Riverbird Sangha. There's a link for you in the show notes. You can practice with us online or over the recordings in our library online. We'll give you 2 weeks for free and a free copy of my new ebook, The What, Why, and How of Yin Yoga. So we welcome and look forward to practicing with you. And without further ado, here's today's talk, The Tiger and Snake Revisited. And then I know, as I said last week, there was a request that I give a brief update about my niece's condition each week. And so I'll just briefly mention that here and then go into our Dharma story. And the update is that there really isn't too much of an update other than she's begun her radiation course of treatments. Those are going pretty well so far. She hasn't had any noticeable side effects from those. At this point, her spirit is good. It seems strong, and we're very grateful for all your concern and the network of prayer and well wish and just energetic, I'd say compassion that many of you have extended. I was able to go down again to Massachusetts for a few nights and see her a little bit, and that relates to today's story in some ways, because last week I brought in an old Buddhist parable and was suggesting that I might try to figure out a way to massage this Buddhist parable so that it would be a child appropriate, that it might be appropriate for a seven-year-old girl who faces a life-threatening serious illness. And in reflecting on and just sharing that story with you last week, it became very apparent to me that this would not be an appropriate story for someone in her condition. And so in reflecting on that story myself over the week, what kept coming back to me was that my initial reflections from last week were pretty incomplete, that there was a lot left to be said, and that in fact what I think my unconscious was doing in bringing that story forward to our sangha together is that I was using, in some ways, the predicament of my niece as a foil for all of us to engage with this story. Because I think the story, which I'll come back to again, the story of the snake and the, or the story of the tiger and the snake, I think this story gives imagery to the human predicament. It makes vivid the conditions of the human predicament. And it, I think, offers, in some ways, a map for stages that occur for us as we go through our life, but particularly stages for us that occur as we encounter or take on a spiritual path, or as we take on a spiritual practice. So we're all here ostensibly because we've picked up a path and a practice to help us try to navigate through our life, or to make sense of our life, or to bring meaning to our life. So I'd like to just give some time to revisiting this story, and try to open it up and give some perspective on it in a way that maybe I didn't do so completely, or do as well as I would have liked to last week in the initial introduction. So just to review, I know many of you are here. The story is a parable about a person, in this case, specifically a man, walking in a field. Sometimes it's in a jungle, but in this version I told, he's walking in a field. And while walking in the field, he suddenly becomes aware that a tiger, a man-eating tiger, is pursuing him, running after him, looking for the tiger's breakfast or lunch or dinner, whatever meal or snack it happened to be. And in realizing that the man is being pursued by this tiger, the man starts to run in terror. So he starts to run. And while running in terror, he sees at the edge of the field a well that he decides to jump into for safety. And in jumping into the well and hoping that the well will bring him safety, as he's in the air of falling into the well, he realizes that at the bottom of the well, there's a coiled poisonous snake or a poisonous viper at the base of the well. And so he reflexively, you know, tries to brace his fall and reaches to the side of the well and grabs onto a root that's breaking through the well wall. There's a root of a tree breaking through the well wall that he is able to hold on to. And so he's suspended there. He's suspended between in the middle of the well, he's hovering over a deadly snake below him. And the tiger is now kind of reaching in over the top of the opening of the mouth of the well, trying to swat down at him to grab him. So he's caught between a tiger and a snake. And there he is, in a very dangerous predicament. And while there, he notices that these two mice start to come out, emerge from the well wall. So two mice come out, and those two mice start to gnaw at the root of the tree that he's holding onto. And it's become clear that, like, sooner or later, their gnawing will succeed and he will lose his grip. He will lose his precious grip and fall. So while he's sort of trapped amidst all of these very difficult conditions, he notices that way above the well, a tree branch is shaking. Some suggest that it's because the way the tiger is leaning into the well, that the tiger's back haunches are pushing against a tree, which is connected to this tree branch that's shaking. And in the shaking of the tree branch, a beehive with honey in it starts to get jostled a little bit, and little drips of honey start to fall from the tree branch down into the well. And when this person notices it, he realizes that he's able to extend his tongue, capture a few drops of the honey. And in the story, his only line that he speaks is what happens after the honey lands on his tongue. So the only line he speaks is, delicious. And like that, the story ends. Cut. That's how the Zen crowd cuts the story. The moment of tasting the honey and articulating, delicious, story's over. So I diagrammed the story out a little bit. And what I the analysis that I may bring here, the parallels or the analogies for our life may be very obvious to some of you, but I just want to spell it out a little bit. And because what I want to suggest, the heart of this talk, the heart of this reflection, and heart of the story is that I think this story is describing not just the human predicament, but the path of practice. The path of practice. It's a very condensed story. It's a very abbreviated story of practice. But in a sense, it is describing the totality of the path of practice. So the story begins with our man walking in a field. And this is at the beginning, moments before he becomes conscious that he's being pursued by a deadly tiger. So you could say this phase of walking in the field is a phase of blissful obliviousness. He has no idea the danger that lurks. He has no idea what's about to descend on him. He's blissfully oblivious. Or a phrase that I used to sometimes gently describe. I used to say this to Terry every time I would return home from Europe on a trip and ride the subway in Boston. I'd say, you know, Terry, I'd text her and say, American culture is the strangest thing. We are so entitled and so oblivious at the same time. This is an entitled obliviousness. We don't even know how oblivious we are. But it's not just Americans. And I'm not speaking about the Americans on this call, per se. I'm speaking about the human condition of, for some of us, we might begin our life or go through phases of our life where we're numb, where we're just disconnected, where we're alienated. We're not even conscious to the predicament we're in. And that goes right back to the Buddha's own story of his own awakening, at least initially, where, you know, the Buddha grew up in a palace, a cushioned, privileged life in a palace. And it was only when he escaped the palace walls and encountered a dead man, a dying man, a very old man, that the inevitable conditions of existence, i.e. aging, illness, and death, that the inevitable conditions of existence flashed before his consciousness and seized him with dread, seized him with fear, seized him with a sense of hopelessness. What do I do here? How do I live in the face of these conditions? Now, I want to add my little asterisk footnote on that is this field that we might find ourselves walking in blissfully oblivious is one that not everyone is privileged to experience. And I think many people throughout the world are born into another stage of this story. They may be born immediately into the consciousness that a tiger is pursuing them, or they may be born immediately into the consciousness of being trapped in a well between a danger above and a danger below. But the story is told from a person who is initially blissfully oblivious. When the tiger appears, you could say this is their first encounter with a real threat to their life, or a first encounter with the real delicacy and fragility of life. And the person's response to experience or encountering the tiger is to run, to seek safety. So I want to pause there and suggest this is another phase of, or another side of the human condition. That in our first encounter with terror, in our first encounter with fear, or in first encounter with true vulnerability, or many encounters with these things, we tend to run. We tend to seek safety. We tend to seek escape. And for many, that can take form of seeking security and safety in conditions, or safety and security in experiences. And in its most painful expression, that looks like any of the various forms of addiction. But usually, you know, and I'm just going to paraphrase someone who said, you know, if you're truly fortunate, you will experience a suffering so great, you'll seek an end of suffering. Which isn't, again, to celebrate the initial suffering, but it's the spiritual orientation to suffering that says, by fully opening to it, we can finally, soberly explore a resolution. We can finally soberly explore a real freedom. So when all the numbing consolations that we tend to distract ourselves with, whether it's, you know, a glass of wine, whether it's just talking on the phone or texting or social media or news consumption or whatever experience we tend to kind of reach for to appease our agitation in facing the terror of our existence. Sooner or later, we find that all of those numbing consolations are completely inadequate. And that is usually the threshold to the doorway of seeking and searching and maybe finding an authentic spiritual path. That when our normal escape routes don't work, when our normal escape routes are seen to be completely inadequate, if we're fortunate, we'll hear about or come in contact with a wisdom tradition or several wisdom traditions, and we start applying ourselves to the sort of the structure and the direction and the development of the path. But I want to suggest that in this story of the man who's seeking safety, the man who's seeking security from the tiger pursuing him, when he jumps into the well, he isn't jumping into a false sense of safety. I mean, he's not jumping into a numbing consolation. What he's jumping into is the spiritual path, the well. I'm suggesting the well represents the spiritual path. And why would I say that? Because you know the story now. He gets into the well and suddenly he realizes the predicament he's in is far worse than he ever imagined. Like it, from a traditional narrative perspective, from the analysis of the story, the difference between his safety when he is in the field and when his safety when he gets into the well, you could say from a traditional perspective, like, or conventional, when he's in the well, he's worse off. He's now got a snake below him, a tiger above him in his position. He can't run anywhere. He's just holding on to a root of a tree for dear life. So why am I saying that the well represents a coming to a spiritual path or coming to a spiritual practice? The reason I'm saying that is because this path that we're on is one that's described as a path of awakening. And I really felt like in the beginning, I had no real sense of what that meant. I was intrigued by it. I was compelled by it, but I really had no real sense of what it meant. A few decades in now, my sense, and I open this up for your reflection, and I think the reason I'm saying this is I feel like what I'm about to say is a way of summarizing the experiences I hear from you in the Sangha. That many of you are reporting that as you continue to practice, your awareness of how bad things are is not becoming duller. Your awareness of how dire conditions are is not becoming like softer and sweeter and more cuddly. Your awareness of the direness of the human condition is becoming more vivid, more acute, brighter, sharper, dare I say, more painful. So the reason I'm saying this is because it's almost like an archetypal phase of practice, in that we begin the practice with a deep sense of trying to bring resolution to suffering. Often we begin practice trying to find some escape from our inner torment or the outer torment that we find ourselves in. And then we come to practice hoping that the mantra, the kindness of the teacher, the loving kindness meditations we do, whether it's a prayer practice or a breath practice, we hope that we will do a practice, we'll do something that's going to change the conditions, that's going to change the situation we find ourselves in. But the opposite seems to occur. The opposite seems to occur in the sense that if it's an awareness practice, meaning it's a practice to come to direct connection to the way things are, not a practice to try to numb out or escape or transcend, but a practice that opens us to the immediacy of what's occurring. If that's the practice we're doing, then our essential predicament, being caught between death and something worse, with time getting gnawed away day and night, that essential predicament becomes more vivid. And as it becomes more vivid, our nightmare of existence as a being that is separate and trying to find resolution within the nightmare becomes stronger or more intense. Now, this is not me just making this up. I just want to be clear too. This is found in many of the old maps of awakening, whether it's Buddhist, the map I'm thinking of and that you see in early Buddhism often describes 16 insights, 16 stages of insights that a practitioner will have over the course of their practice life, culminating in deep insight of freedom. But there are, just to put it briefly, in the middle, there's a stage that has a kind of a strange name, but the experience of this middle stage is one of great bliss, tremendous bliss. Like the body goes up into bliss bubbles. You might see tremendous, like bright showering of light in your inner sky. It feels tremendously free, and it's like better than anything you could ever, any kind of narcotic or any kind of alcohol, anything you could take. You know, this is just an incredible bliss experience. But after that bliss state, there are these stages of insight that are referred to as dukkha, which you know is suffering. So dukkha jnana. Jnana means insight. So the insights into suffering, and there's like four or five of them in a row. And they, in some ways, represent a breakdown of the world as we took it to be. The world resolves into immense recognition of the suffering inherent in all existence. And it's incredibly painful. So the Buddhists call it the suffering insights, or the dukkha insights. But in the sort of the Christian mystical tradition, it's referred to as the dark night of the soul. And I know that's language that many of you have heard of. But that language of the dark night of the soul, is so compelling and so well described in the Christian mystical tradition that almost every serious contemporary Buddhist I know uses that phrase instead of the dukkha jnana. Buddhists don't tend to say, oh, the suffering insight stages. They'd say, I'm in a dark night right now in my practice. Because it's a dark night where the light of freedom, the light of insight, is not apparent, is not on evidence, is obscured. And it's a very confusing, very terrifying, very challenging phase of the journey. And I mention it because I feel that in the shares that I'm hearing, some of you, if not many of you, are at times encountering this part of the terrain. And it is so easy to think that because it's so difficult, it's so easy to think that you, the meditator, have failed, or that you, the meditator, have done something incorrect to bring this deep state of confusion, disorientation out. And it's the opposite. That these insights into the pervasiveness of suffering, these insights into the extreme fragility of the human predicament, are actually stages of the higher stages of development in terms of the transformation of our hearts and consciousness. So I'm just trying to say the experience that this guy in this tiger and the snake story speaks to, that when he's inside the well and trapped there, and his consciousness is fully awake to the dangers above and below him, this is an experience of being fully conscious to what's happening, without any escape routes available. And, you know, part of the reason I'm sharing this, the imagery of this story, is because I'm hoping that the specific images of the story will awaken the conditions of your life that these images signify. So you can see your life, the circumstances in your life, reflected in the images of the story. And so the story itself is like a crutch, in a way, or it's a prosthetic for perception. The story is orienting the listener's mind towards the conditions in their own life that are reflected in the imagery of the story. And we're in this phase of the story right now. So the person is trapped. And while looking up, he notices that a beehive is exuding small drips of honey coming down into the well. And I want to home in on this story's ending, because this is where I think the story's ending really has two potential interpretations, two big potential interpretations. And depending on which interpretation we go with, that can shape the outcome of our journey on the path dramatically. So in the final scene of the story, the trapped man extends his tongue, a few drops of honey land on the tongue, and he says, delicious. And one level, you know, and I'm going to share with you the analysis that this monk Ajahn Brahm gives, one interpretation of that story is simply like this. Brahm says, often in our life, it is as if we are caught between a hungry tiger and a big black snake, between death and something worse, with day and night, the two mice chewing away at our precious grip on life. The moral of the story, he says here, is even in such dire situations, there is always some honey dripping from somewhere. If we are wise, we will put out our tongue and enjoy some of that honey. Why not? When there's nothing to do, then do nothing and enjoy some of life's honey. Now, if I were to share this story with my niece, that might be an adequate, age-appropriate ending. But to you, my venerable practice friends here, I find that story, that interpretation, inadequate. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with smelling the flowers. There's nothing wrong with enjoying a few drops of sweetness, of pleasure. But it almost suggests that practice is just a way of maximizing and seeking pleasure when the shit has piled up around us everywhere and there's nothing else to do. That practice is just a training to recognize what are the available drops of honey in any given moment and to maximize our opportunity to appreciate those. And one way of looking at this man's utterance, delicious, is that that's what he's saying. Enjoy the pleasure, enjoy the sweetness. In my own imagination, as I sat with this image this morning, I don't know how to say this, it's like the whole story itself could be framed as a bad Coca-Cola commercial. You know, there you are trapped and everything's gone to hell and nothing's working out, but hey, you can always reach for that can of Coke and delicious. Or substitute whatever else you want for that can of Coke. So I find, I wrestle with that interpretation. It doesn't square with what I understand of the path to be, which said in many different ways, the path is a path of freedom, independent, not dependent on conditions. It's about awakening to a dimension of peace or dimension of freedom, not dependent on conditions, not dependent on capturing honey drips. The Tibetans have a phrase for awakening called one taste. And they ask people who listen to this reflection to imagine that they come to an ocean. And when you come to an ocean and you have a cup in your hand, no matter where you dip the cup into the ocean, when you taste the water from the ocean, it has one taste. It's salty. And the Tibetans say that just as the ocean has one taste wherever you drink from it, the taste of salt, the Tibetans say, from an awakened perspective, wherever you taste experience, whatever experience you taste, whether it's a terrifying experience, a sweet experience, a boring experience, an agitated experience, whatever experience you taste from the awakened perception, all experience has one taste, and it's the one taste of freedom. In my interpretation of the story, what I want to suggest is that when the man says, delicious, that statement of deliciousness is not in reference to the specific honey sweetness. That taste of deliciousness is his manifestation of his articulation of his own awakening. That in fully confronting the dire circumstances of his life, without flinching from them, which is what the Buddhist path and many wisdom tradition paths emphasize, opening fully to the truth of the way it is. In doing that, a dimension of one's being is able to awaken. And it's by many described as very much like waking up out of a nightmare. So conditioned existence, the condition of being trapped in that well, is the nightmare from which awakening delivers us. But we often think the deliverance will mean we're somehow removed, we're ejected from the well, we're put on a high perch of safety somewhere. That's not true. That's a wish fulfillment. That's a wish fantasy. Awakening is right in the heart of the well. This man realizes a freedom independent of conditions. Ah, delicious. One taste of freedom that's recognized within the specific, but is experienced universally with all experiences. Now, Terry and I were talking about the story yesterday, and I think she gave me the final piece of analytic interpretation that I want to close on, where she said, instead of seeing the drops of honey as, you know, drops of pleasure that we're trying to maximize, she said, the drops of honey are drops of awakening. Drops of awakening. That they're little direct tastes of waking up out of the nightmare. And I think that's, I like that because as I've try to speak about it, my sense of the awakening process is that the practitioner will get glimpses, momentary glimpses of a freedom. But then it's like we're not ready, we're not fully ready to stabilize or to adapt or conform completely to that freedom. We have a whole history of habits, habit patterns of being, that pull us back into its gravitational force and bring us back into the nightmare. And so there's a way that we expand at times into real glimpses of a potential for freedom. And then we find ourselves contracting back and feeling lost and disoriented and confused and not sure what to do or where to go. In other words, you can kind of find yourself in the dark night, get moments of reprieve, and then find yourself in the dark night again. So I'm sharing that, going through the story again. This is the Tiger and the Snake Revisited, because I really think it holds this description of the developmental process of awakening. And if we're not careful, as I hinted at last week, we can, when we find ourselves in these dire predicaments, and this is what I mentioned in my newsletter last week, and when we find ourselves in these dire predicaments, we can use practice as a way to seek pleasure, to seek conditioned pleasure, push away things we don't like. We might tighten up our grip on a little bit of peace with the breathing. The dynamics of practice are co-opted by a pleasure-seeking program. And what's challenging with this is that if you stay with practice long enough, you're likely going to experience states of pleasure that eclipse any other form of pleasure you've ever known. So in a way, practice contains the most addictive drug I could imagine, bliss states. And yet we have to, in knowing that and being in a way warned of that, we don't want to stop the progress of our practice of seeing things as they are. We don't want to stop the forward movement of the caravan by pulling up to a small town with pleasant sights, sounds, tastes, smells, and touches. Want to keep pursuing, delicious, one taste of freedom. Anything else you could say is a sideshow. So we're going to sit now, and the prompt I want to give today is a common one. It's not, this is not my prompt, but I think it's a helpful prompt that helps us begin, or helps one begin to explore the difference between being lost in the nightmare and being awake to the nightmare. And it's a prompt around thinking. And it's a simple question. What's the difference in your subjective experience? So what does it feel like? What's the difference between being lost in your thinking and being aware that you're thinking? That's the question. That's the prompt. When we practice and looking into our experience, when we look into our inner world, become more intimate with the process of our inner world. What's the difference between being lost in a thought and being awake to a thought, or being aware of a thought? The follow-up prompt is, what percentage of your time roughly correlates to each pattern? What percentage of your time is spent lost in thought? What percentage of your time is spent being aware of thoughts? That's maybe a question I'll bring towards the last couple minutes of the meditation. Like, give yourself try to come up with a rough estimate here. It's not to suppress thoughts. It's not to have no thoughts. It's just a simple question. What's it like when we're lost? What's it like when we're awake to thinking?
Okay, I hope you enjoyed today's talk, the story, another pass at the story of the tiger and the snake. I hope that some of my reflections are opening up deeper relationships and explorations in your own interior practice. And stay tuned. We have a lot of new stories coming into the mix based on this particular story. Sangha members have been sort of pinging me with their suggestions for corollary stories or correlate stories. So those are coming. And I'm really looking forward to sharing those with you. But again, if you'd like to practice with me and Terry in yin yoga, qigong, a creative, receptive form of meditation based on Buddhist practice, do check us out at the Riverbird Sangha. We're the community of one practice with many forms, the one practice of awakening the heart and mind. So we look forward to practicing with you. And until the next episode, stay safe, stay strong, keep practicing, and I'll see you soon. All my best.